This is 91.3 KUAF, a listener-supported service of the J. William Fulbright College of Arts and Sciences at the University of Arkansas. And this is Ozarks at Large for Monday, February 10th, 2020. Our show this afternoon will include small things becoming major influencers. We preview an upcoming U of A Honors College lecture about how simple things like string have had a major impact on civilization. Plus, a new head start in Northwest Arkansas opens. After our show, stay with 91.3 for today's Here and Now from NPR. Today, New Hampshire's first-in-the-nation primary is next after the chaos of the Iowa caucuses. The Here and Now crew will be on the ground in the Granite State ahead of the primary. That's beginning at 1 today on KUAF on Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston. The Asian Studies speaker series continues on the U of A campus tonight with an exploration of the sudden worldwide popularity of the Mongolian rock band The Who. Dr. Charlotte de Evelyn of Skidmore College will discuss the nearly overnight success of the band, the new ways global media circulate, and how the band can help us understand traditional and contemporary Mongolian musical cultures. The talk is at 6 in Hillside Auditorium. It's free and open to the public. This is Ozarks at Large. This week, the Arkansas Department of Transportation is holding meetings in our area to talk about the proposed extension of a half-cent sales tax that will be listed on the ballot in November as Issue 1. The extension is part of the governor's $300 million long-term highway funding plan. Part of the plan includes Act 416, which was passed by lawmakers in 2019. The legislation increases the existing gas tax, raises registration fees for hybrid and electric vehicles, and transfers some of the revenue from casino gaming to the highway department. While that will generate $95 million in new revenue every year, the highway department still needs to raise another $205 million. Highway department spokesperson Randy Ort says that's where the sales tax extension comes in. He spoke with Ozarks at Large's Zuzanna Sitek about how the money would be spent and why highway funding keeps falling short.
So why is the highway department asking for a continuation of this tax? Why does the department need this kind of funding support?
I think it's finally been accepted that we have, and not just Arkansas, this is around the country, but we in Arkansas have underfunded our roads for many years, whether it's state highways, county roads, or city streets. I think that people think, you know, I go to the gas pump, I fill up my vehicle, I register my vehicle. All those things are dedicated to highways. And I think it's sometimes easy to think, since we have a dedicated revenue stream, that it's automatically an adequate revenue stream. But the fact of the matter is, it's not. And we have documented a $478 million per year shortfall from just being able to take care of what we consider our basic needs, taking care of our existing roads, addressing congestion where it exists, fixing or replacing our bridges, things of that nature. That does not include, that $478 million per year shortfall does not include major projects that a lot of us would love to see, Interstate 49 in western Arkansas, Interstate 69 in southeast Arkansas. You throw in the total amount that it will take to complete those projects, and the amount skyrockets even farther. But anyway, $478 million in additional revenue every year is a large amount, and it's questionable whether it's even feasible to generate that amount in today's political climate. But the governor has come forward with a plan for $300 million in new revenue, and that's what is partially in place, and that's what the people will ultimately decide the balance of this November.
You mentioned Arkansas is not the only state that has issues keeping up with infrastructure costs and maintenance. What is contributing to that? Why is that the case, that so many states have issues with this?
Well, I think there's two things. One, the Federal Highway Trust Fund was created back in the 1950s to provide money to build the initial interstate highway system. And the trust fund is basically funded through a federal gasoline and diesel tax, a per gallon tax. You currently pay 18.4 cents per gallon per gasoline at the pump. You pay a tax of 24.4 cents per gallon for diesel at the pump. That's the federal tax portion. That tax has not been increased since 1993, whereas inflation has been very hard on the construction industry, the highway construction industry. So while costs to do the work have skyrocketed, revenue has remained flat. The other part of that equation is that fuel efficiency. If 70% of our funding comes from the per gallon tax on motor fuel, whether it's gas or diesel, and it's your goal, it's my goal, it's the nation's goal to reduce consumption, you can see how that has eroded our revenue stream. I don't want to say it's gone down because there are more vehicles on the road. So there are more vehicles buying gas. There are more vehicles paying a registration fee. But again, when 70% of your funding comes from the per gallon tax, it's pretty flat and consumption is flat and declining. But the number of vehicles and the miles being driven total continues to rise. Wear and tear is getting worse, but revenue is not increasing.
So if voters decide in November to continue this tax, where would that money go? What kind of projects can we expect?
Our major focus of this whole thing is to take care of what we already have. All right, preservation projects. Let's take care of the existing pavements that we have. Let's, over the next 10 years, let's make it where we have no weight-restricted bridges on our state highway system, no posted bridges. It's that type of work that 76% of these funds are going to be dedicated to what we call system preservation.
Okay.
The other 24%, we're going to use that for capital-type projects, and those are bigger projects. Some of them on new locations. Some of them are just widening an existing highway. Probably the biggest one in western Arkansas. Everybody seems to want I-49 from Fort Smith southward towards Texarkana. Now, while we won't be able to build all of it, we can actually continue southward from Interstate 40. So if this were to pass come November, we've got $540 million identified for the I-49 corridor extending from I-40 southward across the Arkansas River, tie into what we already have crossing Fort Chaffee, but then continuing south from Greenwood down to Y-City. Now, it's not going to build a four-lane interstate-type highway. It's only going to build the initial two lanes, one lane in each direction through that stretch. But still, that gets the footprint of I-49 on the ground. It would provide a great benefit to the people of western Arkansas.
Does that include a bridge over the river? Or
it will include a new bridge across the Arkansas River.
Okay, I think a lot of people have been waiting for that to happen.
Well, let me point out one other thing here, and because I think this is one of the most important aspects of this. When we talk about highway funding in Arkansas, highway funding, even though it's called highway funding, it gets distributed. 70% comes to the highway department for state highway projects. 15% is distributed between all 75 counties for county road projects, and the other 15% is divided between all the cities for city street projects. So I think it's important to know that while this temporary tax has been in place for 10 years, the highway department portion of that we had dedicated to a specific set of large, expensive projects that we wanted to see get done in that 10-year period of time. Cities and counties, the additional money that they got, 15% each, has basically gone into their general budgets for them to use on on road and street bridge projects. So if this passes in November, we will continue to receive that money, the 70% that we get, but ours won't be tied to a specific set of projects anymore like it was before. We'll be able to use this for system preservation, for building I-49, things like that. But the cities and counties, they've been relying on this. And so if this issue fails in November, every city and county in the state is going to lose approximately 30% of their existing revenue that's used for road and bridge projects. I think it's very important that mayors, judges, other local elected officials understand what's at stake for local road and bridge funding.
The Highway Department has started holding informational meetings around the state about all this, and they're coming to our listening area this week. What are you hoping people take away from these meetings?
Well, first of all, I should have made this clear on the front end. You know, I work for the state of Arkansas, and I can't campaign for this. I don't want to tell somebody to vote for it or to vote against it. But it's our duty and responsibility to inform and educate the public on the issue. We want people to go to the polls and vote, and we want them to make an informed decision, whether it's a yes vote or a no vote. So we feel it's endemic upon us to go out to the public, explain the issue to them, what's going to happen if this passes, what's going to happen if it fails. But we're also using these as listening sessions. What's important to you? This is a chance for the public to come out. We've got about a 45-minute session right at the beginning of it where people can come and look at displays and speak one-on-one with some of our staff if they have specific questions they want to ask. Then we go in and have a formal presentation where we explain issue one, why it's out there, what happens if it passes, what happens if it fails, and then we open up the floor for public comment and questions and answers. So it's been an effective tool. We're kind of trying to raise the awareness. This is early in the year. The vote is not until November, but we wanted to get these meetings underway and completed before the legislature begins its fiscal session in April.
Thank you very much for speaking with us.
Okay. I hope that helps.
That was Arkansas Highway Department spokesman Randy Ort speaking with Ozarks at Large's Zuzanna Sitek. If the sales tax extension doesn't pass in November, it will sunset in 2023. The Highway Department is holding two meetings in our area this week all about this. The first is tomorrow in Mena on the University of Arkansas Rich Mountain campus. The second will be held on February 13th at the Blue Lion in Fort Smith. Both meetings are scheduled to go from 5:30 to 8:30 p.m. A new Head Start Center is opening in Fayetteville. Ozarks at Large's Antoinette Grajeda was at the Friday ribbon cutting for the Head Start. That's a partnership between Economic Opportunity Agency and St. James Missionary Baptist Church.
All right.
EOA and St. James board members, as well as representatives from the Fayetteville, Springdale, and Rogers Lowell area chambers of commerce, were all smiles during Friday's celebration. Senior Pastor Curtis Smith says St. James and EOA share the goals of taking care of those who are disenfranchised and economically challenged. Smith says his church body unanimously approved the partnership.
Because we just believe in investing in young and those that are disenfranchised and don't have the means. And so we just thought it would be a perfect partnership. And even today, when we see these children roam through the halls of this church, it truly blesses us. I am an empty nester, and just to see, with no grandchildren, and to see these children walk through these doors and roam the halls, it is a true blessing. And it is really a gift to us to be able to see them and to have a chance to just interact with them.
The North Street Head Start Center can serve up to 24 infants and toddlers in three classrooms. Delia Farmer, executive director of EOA, says her organization received funding to increase the availability and accessibility of early Head Start services for Fayetteville and the surrounding communities.
And so when we were looking at where the needs were, it pointed to this area of Fayetteville. And St. James happened to be in this area of Fayetteville. And so when we met with the membership, one of the questions we were asked was, so what is Plan B? And thank goodness we didn't have to have a Plan B because this location was perfect for what we needed to do to adequately serve our low-income children and families and make services accessible to them.
To prepare the space for the children, she says they had to modify parts of the building to meet certain fire codes and child care licensing requirements.
So we installed fire exit doors in each of the three classrooms that we used. So how many churches would say, okay, you want to cut doors in our classrooms? Fine. But they said, okay. And then we had to install exit ramps to the exterior of the building with rails. and we had to install a playground on the property that's fenced in, just to name a few of the modifications.
Farmer says children who come to the new center will learn a variety of skills.
Children learn through play, and so these classrooms are equipped with learning materials that are interactive and engage them in that process to strengthen their social and emotional development, language skills, cognitive skills, and motor skills. And we know that parents are a child's first teacher, so family engagement is at the core of what we do in the Head Start program.
The new center brings EOA's total number of Head Start centers to 8. At this time last year, Farmer says they only had 6. More information about Head Start and EOA's other programs is available at eoawc.org. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Antoinette Grajeda.
Ozarks at Large is underwritten, in part, by the Walton Family Charitable Support Foundation. The 44th annual Hogeye Marathon is March 28th in downtown Springdale. This full and half marathon, 5K run, and four-person marathon relay will benefit several local charities. Finisher medals will be awarded. Registration, expo opportunities, and volunteer information available at hogeyemarathon.com.
This is Ozarks at Large. Practically our entire day, from how we wake up, to how we eat, to how we travel, to how we relax, is based on centuries or millennia of invention. I'm Goodman Strauss, a mathematics professor at the University of Arkansas. We'll explore some of the building blocks of civilization in a University of Arkansas Honors College signature seminar next fall and in a preview public lecture Wednesday evening at 5:15 in Gerhardt Hall Auditorium on the U of A campus. The course is called Little Things That Change the World, and a picture that accompanies the course announcement includes several small items like a six-sided die and a salt shaker. We invited Haim to come to the Anthony and Susan Hoy News Studio recently to give us some examples of some of the items he'll discuss. He says this course is years in the making.
Well, I've been thinking about this for, 20-plus years perhaps, and it was only sort of when I began to prepare for the course that I remembered, or actually stumbled across, an article that I absolutely must have read, which was from the 1999 Science Times in the New York Times on the string revolution.
Not string theory.
No, the string revolution. So string is an example. It's like, when's the last time you really thought about much about string, you know?
And how important it is.
But it's not just string. I mean, if you think about what the string revolution gave us, it's like rope, thread, needle, cloth, clothes.
Shoelaces.
Nets. Snares, lines, bags, straps, handles,
bungee cords,
fancy hats, embroidery,
yarn,
beadwork. And so all of this was something that had to be developed and had to be thought out over tens of millennia. Here's something really kind of amazing that is only a fairly recent discovery. I guess this artifact had been discovered quite a long time ago, but like many things, it had to be seen for the first time and only sort of understood what it was. 44,000 years ago, somebody made a rope-making machine. And not really a machine. It's just simply a piece of bone with three spirally holes in it. But it's exactly the same way that rope was made up until, I guess, the mid-20th century, basically. 44,000 years ago. And already at that time, it was a pretty sophisticated – I mean, the holes are actually got little spiral grooves. Just imagine trying to make that.
So the basis here is – without string, a lot of tasks would be much more difficult.
Or impossible.
I'm guessing that so many of the items that you might talk about in this seminar are things that when they were first either invented, discovered, modified, the person who was doing it perhaps out of necessity.
Absolutely.
With no idea.
Absolutely right.
That thousands or tens of thousands of years later,
of course,
it would be.
Of course, yeah. So, we're all acting in sort of our most immediate interest, right? And it's hard to see how could anybody foresee the consequences of, all the way down to, say, B-52 bombers or
right.
Nuclear energy or
so is
space program.
Some of these items are so basic, it would be impossible to deconstruct just when they came in to being.
Maybe.
Or no.
I mean, that's – So lots of this stuff actually is known when, at least some things were invented. You know, I mentioned that the string that this book was called Women's Work: The First 20,000 Years. One thing about paleontology, particularly the older aspects of these inventions, is at any particular time, any particular discovery, you know, it's not the very oldest example, right? Mm. So these dates always tend to get pushed further and further back. And the more recent things, though, some of them can be identified pretty clearly exactly when they were invented. So on the sheet, for example, is the button.
Sure.
Which is a favorite example because it was invented several hundred years after the buttonhole.
So the buttonhole came first.
Yeah,
I'm guessing it wasn't called buttonhole at the time.
I guess it wasn't. I don't know. What, isn't that cool?
That is. So was something like a twig or something used
first?
Yeah,
you've seen it. Like you put a little – you have a little loop of string.
Sure.
And you push a peg through.
It's like what Paddington Bear on his coat uses that. So the button came later. Do we know how much later someone finally thought about the button?
Well, you're putting me on the spot. The book that there's this fantastic book called The Ancient Engineers by L. Sprague de Camp, who is a well-known science fiction writer. He wrote almost as many books as Isaac Asimov and as many on a broad set of topics, and that's where I got that fact.
Okay.
But I've kind of forgotten the date.
Okay. Okay, so let's go to this collage of some of the things that are small but have changed our lives. Now, some of these on here I don't think are that small, like eyeglasses. I mean, that makes sense to me. I mean, that was a revolutionary change.
We're in middle age, and we know how helpless we would be. I don't know if you wore glasses before, but I certainly know the change, and it was but we were useless after a certain age for small, fine work.
Or useless or prey, for that matter.
Right. So, that would be a good example. But, you know, I guess the glass was first mass-produced in about the first century A.D. in Syria. And I guess before that, but certainly after that, people began to notice that, you know, spherical blobs of glass could magnify. Mm-hmm. And ultimately, over the next 1,000 years, those became lenses and then eyeglasses, right? So one can actually trace very well the history of these artifacts.
The key. I mean, we all use keys. I mean, I suppose some people now have keyless cars or doors entry. But the key for I don't know how long has been important. Everything from your house to your car to a trunk to a safe deposit box.
So I have to admit, some of these are sort of meant to be metaphorical for a broader thing. So, yes, you're absolutely right. And there's a whole history there. And it's fascinating to look at old keys, which look impossibly clunky. And, of course, there's been a sort of a race between people cracking keys and people developing keys all along. But actually, I was thinking that in terms of privacy, the innovation of that we have increasingly large amounts of personal space and that our sense of personal space today is, you know, fairly it's extremely recent, right? That we would actually have a room of our own or a space of our own or a place to hide out and not have, you know, 40 people packed into one room with all the things that people do, except I guess the outhouse would be not quite all the things that people do, but taking place in that one space.
So that's interesting. Some of the small things are more abstract or ephemeral than just string or a button.
I view all of this stuff as a metaphor for opening up a discussion, broader discussion. So, for example, the chili pepper is on there, and chilies are pretty interesting in their own right. But it's also amazing. It's an amazing representation of how the new and old worlds met and collided and formed something new, right? That the chili pepper is, of course, a new world crop, and within just a few decades became integral to, like, cuisines all over the world, right? Basically, pick at random, and you're almost certain to certainly chilies are important there, so.
Well, you can even get a little bit more basic or a little bit more universal salt, pepper, spices.
Right.
I mean, what they've become.
So we'll be reading the book Salt by Mark Kalansky. Salt, of course, was critically important for food preservation and so is interesting in that way. But things like salt and pepper, of course, pepper is all about the global trade. You know, it was tremendously expensive in Europe up until, you know, sometime the 17th century or so. And but I actually have on this sheet the salt and pepper shaker, which I think is kind of interesting too, because it's not just the salt and the pepper, but the fact that you would actually have these industrial objects on your table as a sign of just sort of standard middle class life, right? Mm. That everybody, that millions of people could afford these objects and, you know, the stuff to put in it, in it itself is pretty interesting, right? So that leads us to a discussion of the broadening middle class and the rise of the industrial world and so on. So
what's interesting about considering all of these items is how they have to add up. And we get somewhere that individually these items might not have gone, but now our lives are perhaps safer, more sanitary, better because of something created or modified by someone we may not know about.
That's right. This is a, I guess the ultimate theme of the course is that this is a gigantic collective enterprise that no human ever has or could exist apart from other humans, and that millions of minds have contributed to our well-being. In fact, could we just do a little exercise with the listeners?
Sure.
So this is how we're going to begin the course, and I think it's to me it's immensely humbling and a powerful exercise to think about. Just at this moment, just reach out and just touch whatever surface or thing is near you. It may be the tabletop or your steering wheel or your coat or essentially anything. And just think of for a moment of how many people were involved, not just in manufacturing that or shipping it to you or developing it, but then the entire history that is behind all of those things. It's like it's staggering to try to contemplate. It has to be millions upon millions of people that have pushed forward individually on every aspect of this, that this is some sort of gigantic collective enterprise that we've been engaged in together for tens of thousands of years. It's amazing. It's just overwhelming, really.
It's humbling.
It's humbling, and that ultimately is the true point of this course. Even the haircut is kind of an amazing thing.
Tell me about the haircut.
Yeah, so the haircut. So I, of course, as one student sort of rather snarkily remarked, I'm not exactly an expert on the haircut, which I thought was a rather rude comment. But
for our listeners, because you don't perhaps have as much hair as other people.
No, I think you meant because what hair I have is a little unruly.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Whatever.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's really kind of astonishing that just as animals, right, that we evolved over hundreds of thousands of years to have this really bizarre stuff on the top of our heads that requires the active intervention of other humans with tools to manipulate and shape in this kind of way that's a cultural marker that signifies both our status within a group and our belonging to a group in opposition to other groups, right? Haircuts, it's a powerful, contentious thing, right?
Yeah.
What somebody's hair is. Nothing could be more personal and nothing could be more of a signifier of who you are. But yet, like, how did this happen? I mean, it's astonishing. What other creature has a feature that requires the active intervention of other creatures in the kind of a cultural manner? And if you don't, somebody whose hair is not managed, of course, looks like a crazy person or a wild person.
Right? Or God forbid you're a woman running for public office and your hair doesn't look exactly like someone thinks it should.
Or really, I think a man, maybe.
Yeah,
Bernie's hair is pretty unruly, but.
Yeah. I would, you know, argue that a woman has, unfortunately, more attention than
right.
a man.
But one interesting thing is, so one thing that we'll be reading is an excerpt from Charlemagne's Mustache, which is actually about beards and power in the medieval ages.
I know that you said some of these pictures in the collage that you've provided are metaphorical or a launching pad for further discussions. But I do want to ask about one more that's on here, and that's the six-sided die.
Yeah. So that'd be metaphorical.
Yeah.
I was using that as a way to open up a discussion of the quantification of risk.
Mm.
Which is pretty interesting. So people have been gambling for millennia, and it was in the 17th century that the mathematical foundations of probability and statistics began to be formed. And it was really in the context of, you know, in those days, a scientific mind needed a rich patron, often nobility, often in debt from gambling or others in debt to that person for gambling. So it was a kind of, you know, very practical importance to the patrons and a good way to launch into this fascinating subject. So the quantification of risk really was a big step forward, and it really did start with six-sided dice being thrown around or cards being played. Some of the first really key questions came from the following question. If you are playing, say, a game of chance like craps or something, mm-hmm. and then somebody's ahead a certain amount, say you're playing best five out of nine.
Okay.
But the game stops when you're ahead by three. How do you evaluate sort of what a fair payout would have been? What's the expectation of where you'd be from there on? So,
but I can see this used for insurance or actuary tables or things like that.
Absolutely. So risk analysis is a foundation of modern society, like all of these other things, coming from something as simple as a dice.
Ever since I realized we were going to be having this conversation ahead of your public lecture and ahead of the seminar, the honors signature seminar that you'll teach in the fall, I've been thinking about what contemporary things we might be underestimating the future. And what I kept coming back to was the drive-through speaker. Because it seems so banal and so utilitarian. But just think how much easier, for better or worse, it's been to get fast food through a window or that six-pack of beer without having to get out of the car.
Well, the beautiful thing about this sort of perspective, right, is that you can expand the drive-through speaker into any kind of convenience of that sort where it makes us sort of less and less having to go out and do something in the real world.
Chaim, thanks so much for coming in.
Chaim Goodman-Strauss is a mathematics professor at the University of Arkansas and will lead an Honors College signature seminar in the fall called Little Things That Change the World. He'll give a free public preview lecture Wednesday at 5:15 p.m. in Gerhard Hall Auditorium on the University of Arkansas campus.
What are HILDAs? I'm Caitlin Ahrens, the Pluto Manager with the U of A Center for Space and Planetary Science, and this is Scratching the Surface. HILDAs are a very dynamic group of asteroids orbiting around Jupiter, accounting for over 4,000 documented HILDA asteroids. HILDAs move in elliptical orbits just within the orbit of Jupiter around the Sun and have clumped into three separate clusters. Over three successive orbits, each HILDA asteroid approaches all of these three clusters in sequence. HILDA's surface colors often correspond to three different albedos, called the C type being somewhat bright, and D and P types being very dark colored. D and P type HILDA asteroids have colorations similar to those of cometary materials. So this gives us a clue that HILDAs and comets may share a similar origin story. HILDA asteroids are named after the original 153 HILDA, a large asteroid with a diameter of 170 kilometers, so just a few miles longer than the entire state of Delaware. Its composition is mainly very dark carbonaceous materials, and it was discovered in 1875 from Johann Palisa from the Austrian Naval Observatory. There are still many questions yet unanswered about this asteroid HILDA family, such as what causes different coloration of the asteroids in the group? What kind of materials make these asteroids so dark colored? How are these HILDAs related to comets? And why do they form into those three main clusters around Jupiter's orbit? For more on the Center for Space and Planetary Science, or for more segments of Scratching the Surface, spacecenter.uark.edu.
Scratching the Surface with your host, Caitlin Ahrens, the Pluto Manager, is a production of 91.3 FM, KUAF Public Radio in Fayetteville. This is a listener-supported service of the University of Arkansas.
It is Monday, February 10th. Thanks so much for being with us. This is Ozarks at Large. With me in the Anthony and Susan Hoy News Studio is Becca Martin Brown, features editor at the Northwest Arkansas Democrat Gazette.
You think February is going to take as long as January did?
February, even the years it's not a leap year, always seems like the longest month to me.
Oh, golly. This has nothing to do with what we're going to talk about, which is Fort Smith Little Theater.
They're opening a new production for them.
Well, it's also the opening of their season.
Oh, that's right.
They're the only company that's on a calendar year season, not a school year season.
I, in my limited spatial ability, appreciate this very much. I like things to be calendar years.
Oh, and it hurts me because I'm so used to the school year. But they open in January or February with their new season, depending on how quickly they get it together. Last year, I talked to Eric Wells, who's on their production committee, about how they make their decisions. Because it's always fun to say, how do you choose these shows? Well, they have people, directors, that present shows they'd like to do.
Right.
And then the production committee sifts and weighs and contemplates and does all those things production
committees do. You want a balance. You want maybe a comedy, a farce, a musical, a drama.
They say they want to open strong because that's when you're selling season tickets. Mm-hmm. They want to close strong because that's when you're selling season tickets. And then they want a musical, of course, and they want maybe a mystery. Mm-hmm. And then they have one slot that they kind of put more experimental things in or less fluffy and well-known things. Like last year, it was One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest in that slot. So they have announced their season, and it opens with The Glitter Girls, which I think sounds hilarious. It's the same playwright that wrote Happily Ever After last spring. And it's the story of a sorority of aging Southern Belles who get together and wear tiaras.
Okay.
One of them is nearing the end of her life, and she's going to leave a whole bunch of money to somebody. But the other members have to figure out who gets it. And so, of course,
all will go well then,
revelations
right?
and right. skeletons in the closet, and it should be a whole lot of fun. February 13th through 16th and 19th through 22nd. The second show is called A Southern Exposure. Raised in Kentucky by her grandmother and two eccentric aunts, Callie stuns her family by moving to New York to live with her new boyfriend. Her dreams are soon dashed, and she is forced to return home, where she and Hattie, the grandmother, discover the fiercest kind of love. Should be a tearjerker, I would think. That's in April. Oh, gotta go to the June show. They're doing Death Trap.
Oh, that's a fun show.
I love Death Trap. You've seen it with, help me with their names.
Wasn't Christopher Reeve in
the film version? And
gosh, I don't want, it wasn't Albert Finney, but
it'll come back to me in a minute. The premise is that a famous playwright is having trouble writing a hit. And so a young, completely unknown playwright, Michael Caine.
Right, right.
A young, completely unknown playwright sends him a script. And what happens after that is the story, so we're not telling. That's in June. Their summer musical is Annie. I don't need to tell you that story.
Right.
In September, they're doing a show called The Tin Woman. Really sounds interesting.
Is this Oz related?
No.
Okay.
Having received a heart transplant, a young woman is unsure whether she deserves the second chance.
Ooh, I like this premise.
This is in September. And then the last show of the year is called Perfumery, a warm romantic comedy that follows the tangled tale of perfumery employee George, who is fired in a case of mistaken identity and finds that the stranger he has fallen in love with through secret correspondence is a co-worker with whom he constantly feuds, which sounds like pillow talk.
Or a little bit like The Little Shop Around the Corner, or You've Got Mail.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So this should be a fun season. Season packages start at $65, and you can find out more at fslt.org. Three things to think about this week.
Okay.
Cinderella at Northwest Arkansas Ballet Theater.
Mm-hmm.
It's a brand new choreography.
Right.
By their artistic director. 7 o'clock the 14th and 15th at Arid Arts Center in Bentonville. Those tickets are $25. Chocolate Lovers Festival, Saturday.
Eureka Springs.
Eureka Springs Community Center, which is their old high school, 44 Kings Highway, 10 to 3. It's a buffet of chocolate.
It really is. And you go in, you get samples. I went last year, and you come out with more than you can eat in
one day. Yeah, and it's $12.50.
Yeah.
So, again, a good way to save yourself from the Valentine's Day conundrum. And then Shiloh Saturday on the 15th. Is period dancing, 1800s dancing. this is a great freeway. You could make such a good Valentine's date out of this.
And exercise, too. Get the heart racing. Okay.
10:30 Saturday, Shiloh Museum. It's free.
And you'll be back on Valentine's Day, right? February 14th,
Friday. I will. And boyfriend, if you're listening, don't blow it.
Becca Martin Brown, features editor at the Northwest. Wait, doesn't it go both ways? You can't blow it either, right?
I already gave him his.
Okay, very good. Becca Martin Brown, features editor at the Northwest Arkansas Democrat Gazette.
Welcome to 60 Second Civics, the daily podcast of the Center for Civic Education. I'm Mark Gage. The Declaration of Independence was a justification for the American Revolution. Thomas Jefferson used ideas from natural rights philosophy in this argument. He argued that the rights of the people are based on natural law. This means that there is an unchanging set of laws that govern human relations. Natural law is a higher law than man-made law. The founders believed that natural law came from God. No constitution or government may violate the natural law. The only purpose of government is to protect the people's natural rights. Furthermore, the Declaration argues that if a government violates the natural law, the people have a right to change or abolish that government and form a new one. That's all for today's podcast. The show's theme song is Complacent by Cheryl B. Englehart. You can find Cheryl online at cbemusic.com. 60 Second Civics, where civic education only takes a minute.
Tomorrow on Ozarks at Large, Melissa Musnabi says she knew pretty quickly she wanted to perform in John Walsh's play, The Book Of.
There's a couple bits where she speaks in Dari, and Dari is a dialect of Farsi, which is my first language. And when I read that part, I was like, this feels like home. This is the language that I grew up with, and it's in a piece of theater, and I have the opportunity to audition for it.
We talked to actors, playwright, and director of The Book Of, on tomorrow's Ozarks at Large at noon and 7. The Arkansas primary is 3 weeks from tomorrow, and this week the Rogers-Lowell Area Chamber of Commerce will host legislative forums for Republican candidates seeking nominations for State House seats 90, 91, and 94. John Moran, Senior Vice President of Government Affairs for the Chamber, says the sessions are an extension of what he sees as a vital chamber responsibility.
Inform and educate the voters the best we can. That's what I take as our responsibility. We try not to be too Republican, too Democrat, just kind of get the information out there the best we can so people can make the most informed decision that they can when they go into the voting booth.
He says the forums will be moderated, but voters attending will also be able to participate.
But also questions from the audience will be – there will be a time when the audience can ask questions. And also the moderator can field questions from the audience directly. So it's kind of a half and half, if you would say, half debate, half forum.
The first forum for candidates in District 91 is tomorrow night at 6 in the Peterson Auditorium at the Shoemaker Center for Global Business Development on the Northwest Arkansas Community College campus. Forums are free and open to the public. Ross Phillips, the Vice President of Community Development for the Chamber, says he wants to see voters representing the younger demographic of Northwest Arkansas in the audience.
It's just a good way to kind of get some of the younger generation to say, hey, there's a lot of stuff happening at the federal level, but what's here at the state level, that's what's going to impact your day-to-day. So get out, learn about these candidates. And like John said, it's just a good way to just really meet the candidates and know what kind of issues they're behind.
Philip says he thinks it's important, especially in Northwest Arkansas, for voters under 35 to become involved.
I think the average age in Rogers is like 31. So, I mean, we're a young community. We're young up here. And if, you know, we want these, if we really want our voice to be heard, we need to get that generation out to vote and get them informed on what are the issues out there.
The forums for Districts 90 and 94 will take place Thursday night, also like tomorrow night's forum, beginning at 6. Roby Brock, with our partner Talk Business and Politics, will moderate the Thursday night forums. I'll be the moderator for tomorrow night's District 91 forum. The forums are also supported by the Greater Bentonville Area Chamber of Commerce and the Northwest Arkansas Emerging Leaders. The Arkansas women's basketball team is celebrating a historic offensive output. Number 25 Arkansas defeated number 15 Kentucky 103-85 yesterday in Bud Walton Arena. the highest point total against an SEC team in program history, and the first win over a top 15 opponent at home since 2016. Up next, Sunday afternoon game at Mississippi. Other basketball this weekend, Arkansas men dropped a second consecutive overtime game Saturday, this one at Missouri. Both University of Arkansas Fort Smith teams won at UT Permian Basin, and both will host Lubbock Christian in the Stubblefield Center Thursday night. The John Brown teams had the weekend off. They'll both play at Oklahoma City University Thursday night. Razorback gymnastics team recorded its best score so far this season Friday night as the number 15 Razorbacks defeated number 10 Georgia in Barnhill Arena. Razorback softball team 4-1 after the first weekend of the season. They played in a tournament in Las Cruces, New Mexico. They head to another tournament in Fort Myers, Florida this weekend. And the UAFS baseball team now 4-2 after losing 2-3 to Tarleton at home this weekend.
From Little Rock, I'm Stephen Cook with Arkansongs.
See.
Frances Octavia Smith was born in Texas on Halloween in 1912 and raised in Osceola, Arkansas. She married as a teen, had a son, and got a high school secretarial job in Memphis at a company which sponsored a radio program. She was singing at her desk when her boss overheard her and got her to appear on the radio show. Soon, Frances Smith was a full-time vocalist on Memphis radio.
From this valley, they say you are going.
Frances Octavia Smith from Osceola changed her name to Dale Evans when she took a job at WHAS in Louisville, Kentucky. In the late 1930s, Dale Evans moved to Chicago and toured for a year with Anson Weeks' orchestra. Afterwards, she sang on CBS radio affiliate WBBM for 3 years in Chicago. In Hollywood, she was briefly with 20th Century Fox Studios and sang on the Edgar Bergen and Charlie McCarthy show in 1942, one of the most popular radio shows in the country at that time.
Night on the range when it's getting mighty cold, the cattle get restless and mighty hard to hold.
Around this time, Dale Evans starred in some musicals for Republic Pictures. In 1944, she was cast as the female lead in The Cowboy and the Senorita with Roy Rogers, the most popular movie cowboy of all time, and at his peak at that point. She began singing cowboy songs. The two became a duo in more ways than one. They starred in 19 more films together over the next 5 years. Dale Evans and Roy Rogers were married on New Year's Eve, 1947, less than a year after the death of his first wife.
Please bless the roundups year by year, and please don't forget.
Dale Evans and Roy Rogers eventually had 9 children, adopting 4, but only 1 biological child was between them, named Robin. Robin was diagnosed with Down syndrome before she was 2. Both Roy and Dale were religious, and Dale wrote more than 20 books about her religious faith, including a bestseller about how their family dealt with Robin's death and life. Dale also wrote the Christian chestnut, The Bible Tells Me So, among others.
Bomba-dee-da, 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 bomba-dee-da.
Besides her hand in marriage, Dale Evans gave Roy Rogers another great gift, the song Happy Trails, which she wrote. The song became the standard send-off for the duo's NBC television show, which ran for 7 years during the 1950s. Happy Trails is an American classic to the extent that it was humorously covered by one of the most popular hard rock bands of the 80s in 1982, Van Halen, on their Diver Down album, heard here.
Happy Trails to you. Tell we meet again.
From Osceola, Arkansas, here in its entirety is Dale Evans with late husband Roy Rogers singing another cowboy classic, Cool Water.
Without the taste of water, cool water.
Water, water. Old Dan and I, with throats burnt dry and souls that cry for water. You listen to him, Dan. He's a devil, not a man, and he spreads the burning sand with water. Dan, can you see that big green tree where the water's running free and it's waiting there for me and you?
The shadows sway and seem to say, tonight we pray for water, cool water.
Water, water. And way up there, he'll hear our prayer and show us where there's water. Water, cool, clear water. Water. Keep a moving, Dan. Don't you listen to him, Dan. He's a devil, not a man, and he spreads the burning sand with water. Dan, can you see that big green tree where the water's running free and it's waiting there for me and you?
Osceola, Arkansas raised Dale Evans with Roy Rogers singing Cool Water. It's another song of Arkansas. From Little Rock, I'm Stephen Cook with Arkansongs.
Arkansongs is a production of Experiment Station Studios. Producer is Keith Merks. Arkansongs since 1998.
And this is Ozarks at Large for Monday, February 10th, 2020.
This month's Short Talks from the Hill, a research podcast of the University of Arkansas, features Peggy Schaefer Whitby, a special education professor at the University of Arkansas. She discusses an initiative she started in Helena because she noticed kids from Southeast Arkansas weren't accessing state services offered to children with autism and their families. She soon realized it was a therapy desert.
By a therapy desert, what we mean is that there are no therapists to provide the service to these children. So even if these children were receiving diagnoses, they would not be able to receive applied behavior analysis services to treat the autism.
Schaefer Whitby discusses how to help these families and how people in the Delta are a key part of the solution. To listen, you can visit researchfrontiers.uark.edu or visit the on-air and programs link at kuaf.com.
This is 91.3 KUAF, Fayetteville, Fort Smith, Bentonville, and Bleak Creek. 91.3 KUAF is a listener-supported service of the School of Journalism and Strategic Media at the University of Arkansas. Contributors this Monday included Zuzana Sitek and Antoinette Grajeda. Timothy Dennis mastered our show. Scratching the Surface is written and hosted by Caitlin Ahrens, and it's produced by Pete Hartman in the Nancy Blair Operations Studio. Our thanks to Becca Martin Brown and Stephen Cook for their help with today's program. Our theme is titled First Hurrah, and it is written and performed by Daryl Sean. His most recent CD is titled Safe in Sound. We will be back tomorrow at noon and 7 p.m. with another brand new edition of Ozarks at Large. I'm Kyle Kellums. Thanks so much for being with us. Have a great rest of your Monday.